Well, it's happened. A lot of people didn't think it would happen, but it has happened, and so now, well, you got to deal with it. No, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Brexit. And for our English cousins, Brexit is a much bigger deal, potentially, than a single presidential election here in the United States, because Brexit represents major British constitutional change. We've spoken in the past about this several times with Bill Walton. In fact, we devoted two complete episodes to the possibility of Brexit, so I thought it'd be a good idea to have Bill back now for two, count them, two more episodes on the consequences and the potential consequences of this major constitutional change. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional, and this week it's OMG, Brexit.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
Bill Walton is a friend of mine who teaches law at the University of Northumbria in northeast England, and he and I have spoken on a number of occasions. In fact, we recently devoted two complete episodes of this show to talking about a very significant constitutional issue that was then facing the British electorate. It was the then upcoming vote on whether Britain should exit from the European Union, the so-called Brexit vote. Now, at the time I spoke to Bill, we were speaking in hypothetical terms, and the betting, literally the betting, was that Brexit would fail, that the so-called Remain vote would prevail over the so-called Leave vote. Now, this was a nationwide referendum on a major, major constitutional issue, but nonetheless, we didn't think it would ultimately happen. But guess what? We woke up one morning, and it had happened. And here's Bill to tell us what happens next.
I'm William Walton, and I've spoken to you before on some of your previous radio programs. I'm a senior lecturer in law at Northumbria University in Newcastle-upon-Tyne in England, in the United Kingdom. And I'm actually speaking to you this week from the Highlands of Scotland.
From Scotland? What are you doing up in Scotland, sir?
I'm on holiday here. I'm here with my partner, Nicola, and we're going to play some golf, and we stay here in a lodge by the Spey, and it's just the most beautiful part of Britain, I think.
Well, you're playing golf in Scotland, so I have to ask, you're going to go golf on Donald Trump's golf course?
Probably not. Having given evidence against it at the planning inquiry.
Oh, did you really?
I gave evidence on behalf of the local community. Who
yes,
were opposing the proposal, yeah.
That's one of your areas of scholarly interest, isn't it, is land use law?
It is, land use planning. And Mr. Trump's course is about 12, 14 miles north of Aberdeen. And I think it was about 2007 the planning inquiry was held, 2008. And I was asked by a group of objectors to assist in giving evidence at the public inquiry against the proposal. It was very, very controversial because it's not really a golf course. It's a new town which happens to include a golf course. But the interesting thing is, 5-6 years later, is that he's laid out the golf course but not provided the hotel and the other goodies, the economic benefits. Now, the reason that was controversial was because the golf course is laid out on some of the finest dune land and most environmentally sensitive dune land in Scotland. Dune land, yeah.
What is dune land?
Dunes is that area, sandy area between the beach, between the sea and between the land.
Oh, I'm going to laugh out loud now. You're saying dune. I thought you were saying June. Okay, no, okay.
Well, I
know what a dune is. Okay, now I understand. All right.
Yeah. Okay. And the proposal was essentially that Donald Trump was given permission, notwithstanding it meant ripping up an environmentally sensitive area, on the basis that there would be enormous, unparalleled economic benefits from his project. And I think it's fair to say most of those economic benefits have not been delivered. So the dunes have been ripped up, but there hasn't been the compensatory economic benefits provided.
Well, I wish you luck with that. And we, of course, are nonpartisan, so I will not comment on Mr. Trump's candidacy. But I will simply note that, as I often tell my students, land use law sounds very, very dull. And students don't like to take courses in land use law in law school, nor did I. But I did take one zoning course back in the day, and then I found myself in the great state of Florida for the better part of a decade. And I will tell you, and you already know this.
You're going to tell me that you nearly caused a major football match to be abandoned.
That's true. We almost stopped the Super Bowl of 2005 from coming to Jacksonville. That's a whole nother story. What I was really going to say is that it's some of the most emotionally laden law that there is out there, that people get very, very concerned about their homes and about their communities, and there are a host of constitutional issues. So land use law is fascinating.
Well, I agree. And I said to students once that, the average voter doesn't really mind what's going on in Syria or in Israel or Lebanon, but you try and put a new Tesco store at the bottom of their road and they're up in arms about it. So I think it probably reinforces what you're saying.
Indeed it does. But that's not why we're talking today. Of course, we're talking today because I have a question, a very important question that I wish to ask you. Are you ready?
Yeah, go ahead.
What the hell is going on in Britain?
Well, I think the last 2 weeks have been, many proper political pundits, rather than myself, have said the same, that they've been the most tumultuous weeks since end of the Second World War.
I believe it.
It's on that level. It has been unparalleled in terms of the political turmoil, the national mood, if you want to put it like that, and the pace and the magnitude of events that have followed the vote on the 23rd and 24th of June.
And of course,
been quite phenomenal.
Indeed. And we're talking, of course, about Brexit. And I'll ask you in a moment here just to give a thumbnail sketch of that. But let's keep it to a thumbnail because I'll refer listeners, many of whom already know, that we've already done several episodes, notably two with you, that are simply called Brexit Part 1 and Brexit Part 2. And they can simply go online and Google your weekly constitutional and Google podcast, and it will come up. And it's only been a few weeks since we've done it. So it's very easy to find
those.
And we went into great detail, and those were wonderful interviews with you and your students and James and a number of people, all about Brexit, everything you'd ever want to know. But that was all prospective. So just in 30 seconds or less, what has Brexit done?
We don't know yet, is the answer.
That was pithy.
What has Brexit done? Technically, the vote has – I think the consensus is that the vote has – initiated the process to remove the United Kingdom from the European Union. There is, of course, a constitutional issue, which we'll no doubt talk about, as to whether that vote was advisory or whether it's binding. I think the general acceptance is it's advisory, but de facto it's binding, if that makes sense. The expectation is that the political parties will now carry out the process of removing the United Kingdom from the European Union, which is an organization we've been in for 40 odd years.
Right. And I guess what we determined during our previous interviews was that if this goes through, and indeed it looks now as if it will, this is going to be a major, major constitutional change for the United Kingdom because the EU and Britain's place in the EU, though the process was gradual, was starting to look more and more and more like a new federation, a single country that was coming together over the course of decades and perhaps centuries, and had profound effects not on just international trade and international relations for Britain, but on its domestic law. And so if this in fact happens, as it seems like it's going to, this is a major, major constitutional change for your country.
Yes, I mean, to go over all ground, in 1972, Great Britain agreed to join what was in the European Economic Community, the EEC, and that was seen as that. It was an economic community. And since that time, it has transmogrified into, so goes the argument, it has transmogrified into a social, economic, political union with... In time, it would have its own national anthem, its own army, its own defense policy, its own international policy. But there has also been a great deal of political harmonisation, and many people in the United Kingdom and many political leaders and political figures have rejected this, or they have been opposed to it, and they've talked about the European Union as indeed and in a pejorative way. They've referred to it as the United States of Europe. So it would be a little bit like, as I say, it started out as a loose confederation of countries, but now the perception is that the United Kingdom has the same relationship to Brussels as North Dakota does to the United States of America, that essentially law made in Washington, D.C., as part of a federal nation, is essentially the prevailing law. And what happens in North Dakota is almost ancillary to that, if that makes sense. I mean, you know, I know enough about American politics and law to realize it's not quite like that. But you know what I mean?
I think it's actually a very, very good analogy.
In the sense that what's happened is that Brussels has increased its level of authority and its level of power. And the consequence of that is that the individual member states, of which there are now 28, and of course at the time when the United Kingdom joined, there were six, and six became nine, and nine became 15, and 15 became, I think they went to 25 and then to 28. And of course, the possibility of Turkey joining, Montenegro. And it's those that a lot of British people found that quite unsettling. But I think one, again, we'll no doubt talk more about this. One of the big issues really was, what was the referendum about? Was it about that political issue? Or was it essentially about this more emotional issue of labor movement?
Understood.
Population movement.
So just to summarize then, Brexit is like a secession. It's like North Dakota, or perhaps more, even more appropriately or comparably, the great state of Texas deciding that it simply had enough with this federal union that it joined back in, I think, around 1845. And it's simply going to secede.
Texas, yes. I think they're calling it, aren't they?
Actually, there are those in the great state of Texas who are calling for what they now call Texit and a secession.
They're looking at Britain as a role model.
Indeed, they are. And so that's what this is. This is in a very literal sense, it is a secession of the United Kingdom from this this incipient super state we call the European Union. So that's what
I think it is. And I think the parallel with Texas or California is a good one, because – again, we'll come on to talk about this, no doubt, but Norway left the European Union. But that would be like North Dakota leaving the European Union, whereas Great Britain leaving the European Union is more like Texas or California leaving the United mm-hmm. States. It's on that scale because of the size of Britain and its importance. It's one of the big three or four countries in the European Union. It's got the second largest economy, I think, in the European Union. And therefore, it's not like Norway leaving. It's on a completely different scale.
All right.
And it's a threat to the European Union because this issue of contagion, which I guess we'll talk about, which is the possibility of, well, Holland might do the same, or maybe Poland will do the same.
Pexit or whatever, Grexit may happen next. Okay, that's what Brexit is. And again, if people really want to talk about what it is, they can go back and listen to Brexit's part one and part two in our podcast. But now let's fast forward. When we were speaking, although I think you very accurately said that it was a coin toss and that it was very, very close, I still got the sense, at least it was my impression, that probably the Remain vote would prevail, that probably all the betting was correct, and that Brexit would not occur. And then stunningly, it did. And so let's talk about how did you find out about this, and what sort of percentages are we talking about?
Well, I'm a political animal, so I stayed up all night. I stayed up to about 5 o'clock in the morning, and then I lost the will to live and went to bed.
Yeah, and you started sending me emails at about 3 in the morning.
I think by about 2:30, 3 o'clock.
Yeah.
It was around 2:30 that it really looked a lost cause for the Remain. And of course, the interesting thing was it was a national referendum, so it wasn't to do with electoral districts or who's winning, you know, in the north or the south. It's one, every vote counts in a referendum, as you know, mm-hmm. and every vote counts equally. So what we were seeing on the BBC and the other television providers was a running total And by about 2:30, 3 o'clock, the exit had a solid 51%, and the remains had 49%. And London, many of the London results had already come in. Many of the big cities where the Remain thought they would be strong had already declared, and they hadn't altered the figures that significantly. And I think, you know, by that time it was pretty clear what the result would be.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Herrett. I'm speaking with my buddy Bill Walton, a law professor from the University of Northumbria in England, all about what happens next with this strange thing we call Brexit. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Bill. Stick around. How you doing today?
I'm doing great, Stuart. How are you?
I'm doing extremely well. We haven't had any riddles for a while. Do you have any riddles for us?
Sure.
You
absolutely.
Do actually have a riddle. Okay.
Absolutely.
Or do you have just one of those dull multiple choice quizzes again?
No, I've got a riddle. Would you like a riddle?
I'd love a riddle.
Oh, that would be great.
Tremendous. Do we have a guy on the line who would like to hear a riddle?
Yes.
Who are you, sir?
My name is Chance.
Uh-huh. Where are you from, Chance?
I'm from Chattanooga, Tennessee.
You are from Chattanooga, Tennessee. Well, I'm looking forward to this. Oh, and I'm being clad. I'm going to guess that this next riddle has something to do. Well, I'm not going to say because I don't want to give anything away, but I'm just going to say that I'm being clad with something here. It's a flag. That's all I will say about it, and we'll have to explain the rest of that later. But thank you, Doug, for doing that.
Absolutely.
Okay, and now give your question to Chance. Let's take a chance.
We're going to take a chance?
We're going to take a chance on Chance.
I want to sing ABBA, but we won't.
Okay, please.
Okay, Chance, I'm going to read the riddle, and I'm going to give you four choices. Are you ready?
All righty, yes.
I once ruled the world where the sun never sets. I survived two world wars, but have lost more than a few revolutions. The most recent might have been internal. What country am I?
Mm.
Am I A, Great Britain, B, France, C, Russia, or D, Egypt?
Do you need to hear those again, Chance?
I think I've got it. Britain, France, Russia, or Egypt.
Mm-hmm. And what's the riddle again?
I once ruled the world where the sun never sets. I survived two world wars, but lost a few revolutions. The most recent may be internal. What country am I?
I know the answer to this because you handed me the appropriate national flag.
I did.
I'm displaying it, but Chance, you can't see it.
I handed Mark an affiliate flag as
I
well.
See. Okay. Chance?
I will have to say I don't think it is either of C or D.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go with my gut and go with Britain.
With Great Britain. The United Kingdom. And why not? Why not C? Why not C or D? What were those again?
I'm fairly certain it's not Egypt. Russia was throwing me through a little loop. Obviously, sun never sets. That sounds a little tempting. Still thinking Britain. Why don't we read the riddle one more time?
I once ruled the world where the sun never sets. I survived two world wars, but lost a few revolutions. The most recent may be internal. What country am I?
I'm going to go with Britain.
I can't get him off Britain, Doug.
Yeah, because he's right. A, Great Britain, the sun never sets on the British Empire, of course.
Indeed.
Survived two world wars, but might have lost a couple of revolutions, if you think about that.
Yeah, one I can think of.
Yeah, the American Revolution.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what was the last portion of that, the internal?
Yeah, well, of course, it's Brexit.
Right.
This new kind of internal revolution. You know, it's interesting. Great Britain survived the Scottish exit vote.
Mm-hmm, they did.
A few years ago, and to the surprise of many.
Right. People thought that Scotland might actually secede from Britain.
That's right. And then Britain decides it wants to secede from the EU.
Which may lead Scotland to secede from the UK.
And then that, of course, makes Wales just a little jittery.
Wales, exactly. And I don't know. I think Northern Ireland will probably stay.
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because, you know, probably do is ask a specialist in Brexit. The reason I say that is because if I were in Ireland, I might look at unifying the island now. Because my guess is both Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic both want to be in Europe. Wouldn't that be something if that brought Ireland back together?
That would be a remarkable outcome. But we're getting a little ahead of ourselves here. All fascinating to think about. But most importantly, Chance, you've won. So please send us an email. Absolutely. Congratulations. Send us an email, ywc@montpelier.org. Give us your T-shirt size, and we'll send you a T-shirt, and we will send you a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier.
That sounds great.
Tremendous. And thanks, Doug. We appreciate you.
You bet. Hey, it's this constitution. We read it for the articles.
The United Kingdom, birthplace of the Beatles, and yet very much the world's Ringo. Now, on Thursday, the UK faces an in-out referendum on whether to leave the European Union. And incidentally, an in-out referendum is also what most English people call sex. I say, that was a jolly good in-out referendum, Priscilla. Capital stuff, old girl. Simply capital. You may not have heard about this referendum unless you watch financial networks, where it's usually referred to by a catchy name.
There's a lot of fear out there in the marketplace about the Brexit vote that's coming up.
Brexit fear is gaining traction.
A new survey this morning focuses on Brexit fears.
Brexit is one of the major concerns in the market at the moment.
I think that the scariest thing about Brexit is the name Brexit, because it's unknown. I mean, it's like, wow, Brexit. Whoa, be afraid, conjuring Brexit.
Okay, calm down. Brexit doesn't sound scary. It just sounds like a granola bar you buy at the airport. Hey, this tastes like a preserved owl pellet. F*** it, I'm going to Cinnabon. You push me into it. And I know, if you are watching this outside the UK, you're probably thinking, why should I care about what Britain does with the EU? Honestly, as long as those crooked-toothed scone goblins keep shooting out royal babies in episodes of Doctor Who, I don't give a tally-ho f*** what happens there. And fair enough, but a Brexit or British exit could have wide-ranging implications both for the UK and the world's economy.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today we're talking about Brexit. This is something we've talked about before, the British exit from the European Union. We're talking to British law professor Bill Walton from the University of Northumbria, and just before the break, he was telling us how he found out about Brexit in the wee hours of the morning, and how it really came as quite a shock.
But it did surprise a lot of people. It did surprise a lot of people.
Did it surprise you too?
I think I was open-minded as to what the outcome would be. But I did read a day before that a political scientist had said, looking at blogs and social media, had come to the view that the outs would win.
But the betting was going the other way.
The betting was going the other way, yeah.
Right, and that really kind of brings up something else. I mean, the pollsters will always say, you know, if you put your money where your mouth is, and the betting markets typically are more accurate than the polls. And so that's kind of what I was listening to. Well, you know, the people who are putting money on this are saying there's like a 70-some-odd percent chance that the Remain vote will prevail. I wonder how they got it so wrong.
I think they probably underestimated the depth of the feeling, particularly in the North. To move on to sort of the political analysis of this, the exit vote was almost delivered by white working class people in the North of England. I mean, that's an oversimplification, but if you look at big cities like Sunderland and Leeds, Newcastle had a wafer thin majority in favour of Remain. But many other big northern cities were very, very solidly to leave, to exit. And part of the problem was, and again, no doubt this is part of the discussion about Labour's leadership, is that Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, was a very unenthusiastic advocate of Remain. He came to the decision that he would campaign for Remain But he didn't go on the national debates. He just went to local village, you know, town halls and village halls. And what political pundits made the comparison. He said that Jeremy Corbyn looked like a captured Western soldier by, you know, somebody who's been captured by a Middle Eastern regime, who's put in front of a television camera, denounces his own his home country, and advocates the regime which has captured him. In other words, he takes a position which is entirely contrived and unenthusiastic and forced. Mm-hmm. And that's how Jeremy Corbyn came across. And I think that's why a lot of people in the Labour Party are very angry with him, that Labour didn't really deliver the number of Remain votes that they were hoping for.
Oh, dear. So we're all stunned. Brexit occurs. What happens next?
Well, first of all, there's this issue about whether a vote would be required in Parliament. Well,
forgive me for interrupting. I should have said what happened next. The first thing was that David Cameron resigned.
That's right.
So the government falls.
I think I said to you, I didn't say on your radio program, and I sent you an email of, a few weeks ago. I said one thing I should have said was that if the exit win, Cameron's a dead duck.
And he lasted about 20 minutes after the vote came in.
That's right. And he resigned at about 6:30 on the Friday morning.
Right.
And I think that shocked a lot of people, because he had said that if he lost, he would remain as prime minister and see through the process and, you know, go along with the decision. But he had campaigned so passionately in favour of remaining in the European Union. And I think that was one of the problems, that he made a number of statements which were just, they weren't borne out by analysis. They were seen to be ridiculous. He was saying essentially that the reason you've not had war in Europe since 1945 is essentially because of the European Union. Now, I think the European Union has been a great civilizing influence, and I think trade does bring countries together, and I think it's part of that process of keeping Europe at peace. But I think it was a degree of emphasis which David Cameron gave to it that it didn't really have credibility. And David Cameron was very, very much the leader of the Remain campaign. And I also ought to say, for the benefit of your listeners, there were two out campaigns. There was an unofficial and an official one, because if you were the official out campaign, you benefited from under our election rules, you got money for electioneering. Mm-hmm. The unofficial campaign was led by Nigel Farage of the UK Independence Party, and we've spoken about them before. And the official out campaign was led by Boris Johnson and Michael Gove, and Boris Johnson and Michael Gove were both cabinet ministers. And David Cameron had said that before the referendum started, he said if any of the cabinet want to campaign for exit, they can do and remain as cabinet ministers. But what he then said was, I will not go on television and debate against my colleagues in the cabinet. In other words, no blue on blue. Everybody wanted to see a blue on blue debate. You know, it'd be a bit like, Barack Obama debating against Hillary Clinton,
right,
and tearing each other apart. And everybody wanted to see it, but
that would have been exciting. Two or three conservatives out there, Tory against Tory, debating this. In fact, that was quite an extraordinary thing for David Cameron to do, to give them free rein in that respect. I mean, I think a lot of prime ministers would have said, if you're not with me, then I need your resignation.
Yeah. Well, I think it's because Europe is so deeply divisive. There are a lot of people within the Conservative Party and within the Labour Party, as we've discussed before, for whom, it's a little bit like something like gay marriage. You know, it's one of those issues which is seen as also more an issue of conscience than an issue of politics. Mm-hmm. That may seem a bit strange, but to get anywhere in a Conservative Party nowadays, when you go through a selection committee at local constituency level, if you're in favour of the European Union, you're probably not going to get selected. So at grassroots level, there's a great deal of anti-European Union feeling. And of course, that manifests itself in terms of parliamentary representation. The Conservative Party over the last 20, 25 years has become increasingly anti-European because we don't have centralised politics, probably in much the way you don't. You know, if you want to get selected by, you know, North Virginia or Northeast New York State. Yeah, something like
that. Yeah, right.
A district. It's very much down to the local constituency parties, to who they select.
Right.
And it's nothing to do with national headquarters. And so the consequence of that is that the Conservative Party has become much more Eurosceptic over the last, I'd say, 20 years. And parliamentary representation has reflected that. So if you'd had said in the cabinet, well, anybody who's in favour of exit, I don't want to have any more to do with them, you know, you would have lost a lot of cabinet ministers. So he allowed them that leeway. And as I say, quite a number of them actually, you know, took the exit line. And they're now like the cat that got the cream.
Well, the cat that got the cream and then left the House, because then the next thing, I those of us watching across the Atlantic Ocean watched as person after person after person started resigning.
Well, that was certainly in the Labour Party.
Yeah, what was going on with that?
Well, do you want to stick with the Conservatives or do you want to go back to Labour?
Whatever's most logical. You know more than I do.
Well, certainly on the Labour side, what then happened in that remarkable day, I think it was a Monday following, so it'd be about the 26th or 27th of June, which now seems a long time ago, but it was only, 10, 12 days ago. But on that day, I think on the Sunday evening, Hilary Benn offered his resignation. Now, he's a shadow cabinet minister. He's the son of Tony Benn. He's a very eminent Labour politician. And he said to Jeremy Corbyn that, "I have no confidence in you as leader." He resigned, and then over the next 12 hours the following day, I think there were 8 or 10 shadow ministerial resignations. And then the following day, there were another half dozen or so. And then a week later, there was a vote of no confidence in Jeremy Corbyn by the Labour Parliamentary Party, who have about 220 members. And there were 172 members, I think, who voted against Jeremy Corbyn, and only about 41, 42 who voted in favour. It's a vote of confidence. So it's not, on itself, it doesn't mean that you're out, but it means it's very difficult to stay in. The issue now with Jeremy Corbyn is that Jeremy Corbyn has great support at the grassroots level. So he has that constituency who really support him, but none of his colleagues, or not many of his colleagues, support him in Parliament. And now we've got a Labour leadership election coming up, by the look of it, with Angela Eagle, who's thrown her hat in the ring and said, right, I am formally going to run against Jeremy Corbyn, and there's going to be a leadership election. Let's talk about that a little later, because that raises a constitutional issue about whether there will be a court issue, because Jeremy Corbyn may not, and I'll explain why later on, Jeremy Corbyn may not actually be able to stand in the election against the challenger, because he may not have enough support within the Parliamentary Labour Party to actually get nominated to go through to the contest.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about Brexit, the British exit, the imminent, it seems, British exit from the European Union. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll continue our discussion with Bill Walton, a law professor from the University of Northumbria in England. Stick around.
England swings like a pendulum do. Bobby's on bicycles 2x2. Westminster Abbey, the Tower of Big Ben, the rosy red cheeks of the little children. Now if you huff and puff and you finally save enough money up to take your family on a trip across the sea.
Critiques of James Madison as a president largely center on his lack of energy in the White House. Some complain of his inability to control his cabinet, an inability to control his party in Congress. He was perceived as weak-willed by his fellow Washington politicians because he did not inject himself into the legislative process. bold leadership was not part of Madison's concept of the presidency. But his critics also agree that during the War of 1812, he showed remarkable respect for the civil rights of his domestic foes. And in that way, Madison's presidency, however criticized for a lack of wartime leadership, is ultimately a triumph in that it proved that the U.S. could wage war and not sacrifice the civil liberties enjoyed by Americans. If Madison is judged by a standard, which he himself would have used, that grades presidential behavior on faithfulness to the Constitution, then he is a model president. With your Madison Minute, I'm Jen Patia Howell.
Straight away with the United Kingdom, a place whose very name after this week's events is beginning to sound a bit sarcastic. Because the UK this week voted to leave the European Union, a decision that has shaken the world, and not in a Muhammad Ali beating Sonny Liston kind of way, more in a those IKEA meatballs you love contain horse kind of way. And the fallout in Britain has been swift and significant.
The Brexit decision is off to a bit of a rough start here in London. At least stocks were in free fall, the pound historically weak, and the country's in the market for a new prime minister.
That's right. David Cameron announced he would be stepping down in the wake of the vote, which should make me happy, but in this situation, it doesn't. It's like catching an ice cream cone out of the air because a child was hit by a car. I mean, I'll eat it. I'll eat it. It's tainted somehow. And before you have any sympathy for David Cameron, you should know this whole vote was his idea in the first place.
We will give the British people a referendum with a very simple in or out choice.
Yes, Cameron proposed the in or out choice himself. Meanwhile, the Brexit vote has boosted its two most vocal backers, Nigel Farage, leader of the UK Independence Party and three-time cover model for Punchable Face magazine, and Boris Johnson, a shaved orangutan with Owen Wilson's hair. And before and after the vote, both men drove home a common theme.
I believe that this Thursday can be our country's Independence Day.
Let June the 23rd go down in our history as our Independence Day.
Okay. Just a couple of things there. First, Britain was already independent. In fact, it's what many other countries celebrate their independence from. And second, the sequel to the movie they're quoting actually opened this week and features the wholesale destruction of London, which is beginning to feel pretty fucking appropriate right now.
And now it's time to finish our discussion with Bill Walton, a professor at the University of Northumbria. Or I should say finish for today, because as you'll see, this is such a complex and significant topic that we're going to have more than one episode devoted to Brexit. Before the break, Bill was telling us about many of the political consequences that have already occurred in Britain. The government has fallen. The Labour Party is in disarray. Maybe we'll even have a new British party come to the fore.
But before we go back to the Conservatives, let's just note the Conservative Party is in disarray. The Labour Party, it looks like it's disintegrating. Mm-hmm. And then the UKIP Party, Nigel Farage.
He resigned as well.
It's like everybody running away from Brexit.
Yes. And that's the way it's been portrayed, that many of the people, going back to the Conservative Party, many of the people who were the advocates of exit have gone. So obviously David Cameron was pro-Remain, but he's gone as Prime Minister. But then the favourite for the leadership to take over David Cameron was Boris Johnson. Now, Boris Johnson is the mayor of London. He looks a little bit like Donald Trump in terms of hairstyle.
Yeah,
he's very, very recognizable, white, blondish hair.
Very impressive hair.
Intellectually, extremely capable. Classics at Oxford. And he comes across, maybe he is a sort of, he comes across as a buffoon, and maybe that's where he likes to present himself. But in reality, he's an exceedingly capable individual. He's also a Conservative MP for Ealing, or one of the West London constituencies, which interestingly is adjacent to Heathrow. Mm-hmm. And I say that because Boris Johnson has been the arch advocate of closing Heathrow and opening a new London airport in the Thames estuary called Boris Island. But we'll maybe park that for the moment. But he was seen as a natural successor, apart from George Osborne. Now, George Osborne has been the Chancellor of the Exchequer for 6 years.
That's like your Treasury Secretary.
Yes, and he sat alongside. So he's really David Cameron's number two.
Right, yeah. Always seen as the second most powerful after the Prime Minister. Okay.
Exactly. And he was also in favour of Remain. And within a few days of the vote, he announced publicly that he said, I think I'm tarnished by the referendum decision. I'm not really the person who could lead the Conservative Party through the Brexit process. I'm not best placed to serve that in that capacity. So he ruled himself out. And I think I said to you that Theresa May was seen as somebody who'd kept a very low profile. She was almost invisible throughout the referendum campaign.
She's another conservative MP.
More than that, she is, but she's also been Home Secretary.
Right, very important post as well.
Yes, and also a very thankless task, because Home Secretary deals with terrorism and prisons and the police force and all things that can go wrong. And she's the longest serving Home Secretary in British history, at only 6 or 7 years. So she served in the coalition government and then the first year of this government. And, of course, many people have said, well, hang on, Miss May or Mrs. May, you've presided over this record immigration figures. You're the Home Secretary. And we've not been able to control immigration from the European Union. Well, we can't do anything about that because of the Treaty of Rome and the fundamental freedom of movement. But also, a similar number, about 150,000 each year, have been coming in from outside the European Union, which you, as Home Secretary, could do something about. And she's not. So many people suggested, well, hang on a moment, why do we want Theresa May as Prime Minister, given her record on immigration? But nevertheless, she is seen, notwithstanding that, by many people as very competent, a safe pair of hands, a hard worker, diligent, which, as I said to you again, I think in an email, is maybe to damn with faint praise, because it makes her sound as if she's a very effective bureaucrat, but not much more.
But haven't I just seen that it looks as if she is now
she's now
going to
be Prime Minister.
She's going to be Prime Minister.
From Wednesday evening onwards, yeah. So
we do have a transition, but here's the thing now. It seems that the common thread is...
Just let me... Oh, please. Whilst the thoughts in my head. Boris Johnson then got stabbed in the front or stabbed in the back by Michael Gove. Michael Gove and Boris Johnson had gone around the country leading the Out campaign. And Michael Gove was seen as a very loyal number two to Boris Johnson. Also very, very intelligent in his own right. And it was assumed that he would not stand against Boris Johnson for PM, for Prime Minister. And the rules of the Conservative Party are that you can have, you know, you could have 6, 7, 8 candidates, but only two can go through to a final, to a runoff in where the votes, where the constituency members vote, which is 150,000. Mm-hmm. So the first stage of the contest is determined by the votes of parliamentarians. And the leading two, after eliminations, then go through to this second stage where the constituents and constituency members vote. And once Michael Gove threw his hat in the ring, many people realise that if he'd be after the same vote as Boris Johnson, and that would leave Theresa May in a very much stronger position. And, of course, it was Andrew Leadsom who actually won through to the final, and she shot herself in the foot over the weekend with these comments in the newspapers. And she was a very strong Brexiteer.
What comments did this woman say?
Well, she made reference to the fact that she had children and Theresa May didn't.
Oh, dear.
And that's what a lot of people thought that was so far below the belt and so improper as to rule her out. And Andrew Leadsom has only been an MP for 6 years. She was part of the 2010 intake.
And she was criticizing Theresa May for being childless?
She's criticizing Theresa May for being childless. And the other thing is that only a couple of days before that, the press had done some research on her CV and found that she had somewhat aggrandized or exaggerated her level of importance in the city. And so within what, 48, 72 hours of her getting through to this second stage, her trustworthiness and her judgment was under such fundamental scrutiny and attack that she decided this morning to call it a day.
That was Leadsom.
That was Andrew Leadsom. And, right, and okay. A consequence of that, because there were only two at that stage, once she withdrew...
That means Theresa May is now basically...
By default, that Theresa May is now the Prime Minister.
Well, that's it for this week with our interview with Bill Walton. We're going to stop it there. We're going to return to Bill next week, but I thought it was a good dramatic point to leave it with the government in London completely in disarray, everybody resigning, a new Prime Minister on the horizon. Golly, it really is like Game of Thrones. I also have another interview here with a young woman. Her name is Claudia Salvatore. She's a James Madison Fellow, and she's just back from Europe, where she was studying the European Union.
Hello, Stuart. My name is Claudia Salvatore. I am from Chicago, born there and raised
in the
suburbs.
Do you know Barack Obama?
I do not, unfortunately.
Michelle?
Nope, but I'm hoping to one day. Perhaps it will happen, perhaps not.
Okay, and you graduated from college there recently.
I did. In December 2013, I graduated from Loyola University in Chicago.
A fine place.
It is. I loved it, enjoyed every minute of it. I graduated with a BA in International Studies and a BS in Anthropology. And following that, I attended JMU's MA program in European Union Policy, and that was based in Florence.
So James Madison University's got a Master of Arts program. Florence.
They do.
Focused on
European Union policy.
Which brings us to why you're here today. Well, actually, you're here today because even more recently, since getting back from Florence, you are now working with Doug Smith.
Yes.
And with Jen Howell and Emily Voss and Mark Trickett and all of our good friends mm-hmm. over at the Center for the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. All of those wonderful people.
As a JMU Fellow, right? Is yes. that your...
The official name is JMU Engagement Fellow.
JMU Engagement Fellow. Mm-hmm. And you and I are going to be working together in a variety of projects, I understand.
I believe so.
And I'm looking forward to that. But again, that's still not why you're here. It's because of that EU thing. Because of Brexit. Because speaking to Doug this morning, he tells me that you... are very interested in Brexit, and you have now the academic background to discuss it. So what do you think about this exit of Britain from the European Union, which you've just so lately studied?
That is a very heavy question, which I will answer with I am following it very closely. I told Doug earlier, it broke my heart a bit to see it actually happen. If you had asked me a month ago whether I thought that the UK would vote to leave, I would have said, no, I don't think that they will, but I was actually quite surprised.
Really? You say it breaks your heart. Why does it break your heart?
I guess having chosen to study the EU for my graduate program, I guess it can be assumed that I am very interested in seeing that this project has the potential to succeed. And so...
Let's talk about that.
Sure.
You use the term project, mm-hmm. and I've heard it described as the European project. Mm-hmm. But in your words, what is the European project? What does the EU represent to you?
Well, it started out as an experiment, and I think that's we can kind of use a parallel, which some people may not agree with the U.S. It also was a very risky experiment that, in this case, with the EU's case, it started after World War II mm-hmm. with six countries. They had formed the European Coal and Steel Community, and so this experiment turned into a project when more and more countries decided to join for various reasons. In the U.K.'s example, they had chosen to finally join what is now the EU because they had seen that its economic growth was pretty stable, and they saw several advantages in joining because modern UK does not have as much political clout as it used to.
Right. This all does go back to World War II. In mm-hmm. fact, it goes back many, many years before that. Many people think of the EU as primarily a trade union. That's not the best way to say it, a union of trade, you know, a free trade union. Mm-hmm. And it certainly is that. And, you know, many people are very concerned about those issues, bread and butter economic issues. But when I hear people talk about the European project, I think maybe they're talking about something even deeper. And that's the history of Europe going back hundreds, thousands of years. People in Europe just have been killing each other in terrible ways and in increasing numbers with increasing efficiency. And, of course, the apotheosis of that was World War II. And so my sense is that the European Union, the people who truly believe in it, see this as a way to bring people together, certainly through trade, but in other ways, and thereby avoid that kind of terrible history repeating itself.
Exactly. And I think some people forget that it really, really did start when Winston Churchill suggested this mm-hmm. sort of project, and among others, of course, that it was kind of a way to rein in Germany to make sure that they wouldn't rise to power again and, you know, throw in chaos. And Europe does certainly have a history of animosity, but this project does have a very strong essence of idealism in the sense that, you know, unity, they wouldn't call themselves the United States of Europe. That's not a thing. But this unity, this union, political union as well, not just a trade union, could hopefully bring about in its simplest form of sense of peace to this region.
And it's been remarkably successful in that regard.
It has. It really has.
Think about that. In the EU, does anyone even consider the possibility of war these days?
It really isn't an option. It really hasn't
right.
been. No, it's
And think about that. France and Germany have been at war like in the last 100, 150 years, like what, 50 times? I mean, certainly I can think of three off the top of my head. Major wars going back at least 1875. So it was a recurrent thing. And then all of a sudden, it's almost unthinkable that France and Germany would go to war. They might have some disagreements, but they work it out.
Mm-hmm. And it's also unthinkable that a lot of EU citizens would maybe not necessarily agree with Angela Merkel, but they look to her to see what she decides in terms of policies and how she leads not only Germany, but she is a very symbolic leader of the EU as well.
And that's what people are concerned about. They're concerned that this may be the first of a mass exodus from the EU.
Yes.
That if one major country leaves, others may get the same idea.
Exactly.
And that would be the failure of the European project, which brings us back to your heartbreak. And also, you pointed out something else very, very important, and that is that this was, to a great extent, a British idea. Churchill is so quotable, but one that comes to mind now. Let me see if I get this right. I do not fear the judgment of history because I intend to write it myself. And this is Churchill's legacy to some extent, isn't it?
Yes, it is. That was a very impressive
voice. Thank you very much.
Yep. But it was
I'm much better looking than he was, but I can sound the same. Okay.
It was very much his legacy of so many people. And I keep thinking back to the original framers of the U.S. Mm-hmm. We are their legacy. The EU is the legacy of so many people as well. Very much some of the same hopes. And with the UK leaving, I mean, of course, there's always talk about it, whether or not there will be a second referendum, mm-hmm. whether Parliament can enact Article 50 of the Treaty of the European Union, which was brought in by the Treaty of Lisbon.
Right.
There are so many questions still. And the biggest question, I think, is how does the UK move from here? How do they go on from here? And how does the EU treat the UK? Because, as you mentioned before, they are a bit hesitant about other nations leaving the European Union. So if they show not too much, if they show some leniency with the UK leaving the EU, then other countries may be more eager to
follow. Okay, Claudia, I think we can solve this.
Mm-hmm.
I think you need to write a letter to the Queen.
Mm-hmm.
You just tell her, this is Claudia. You're breaking my heart. And no doubt she'll put an end to this.
I hope so.
Okay. Thank you, Claudia.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Stuart.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Claudia Salvador for telling us what she thinks about Brexit. A perspective that I think is particularly interesting, given that she's just studied the European Union and that she represents perhaps the views of the younger generation. Thanks also to Bill Walton of the University of Northumbria. We'll continue our discussion with Bill next week. This is a subject that needs more than one episode, I think. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our Madison Minute is by the incomparable Jen Patia Howell of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.